Shiva. Shiva, Shiva.
Let me in.
Shiva, Shiva.
I want to be closer to you.
Shiva, Shiva.
Open up your soul.
Shiva, Shiva.
Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or, if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. It's the first Monday, and I am so lucky because I have a science envoy here to talk. Well, not actually physically here, because through the magic of radio, I could talk through him to him remotely because he's conducting an experiment, which I'm hoping we'll hear all about. I'd like to welcome Ryan Rogers. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, Marilyn. How are you?
I'm doing great. So where are you doing your experiment right now? I mean, I know you're on your lunch right now, but where are you doing it when you go back?
My experiment is taking place in some aquaria, so some tanks at the Hopkins Marine Station in Monterey.
Wow. I've got a ton of questions for you about, but I want to do this in the proper order. So I want to start with, before we get into what you're doing, when did you fall in love with science?
Oh, yeah. I would say, so I grew up in Durham, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a forested region of the state. And a lot of my early science memories involve collections and ID. So going around my backyard and looking for different butterflies and different plant leaves and rock types, and really just categorizing and sorting and thinking about what I was seeing in my backyard. And I think in hindsight, I view these experiences as being scientific in nature, but mm-hmm. it took me a long time to sort of see them as the spark for my interest in science, because I think of science as being very technical, mm-hmm. and you need, you know, a lot of lab equipment and really big skills. And I think that science in its purest form is observation.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think that those observations we make, especially when we're curious, really have a power to engage us beyond. And so I would say my spark for science definitely started with some of my own childhood observations of the natural world, just in my backyard.
So when you're running around or walking around your backyard as a kid, what were your parents thinking? Were they thinking, what's up with this kid? Or were they thinking, he's staying out of trouble?
I think they were definitely glad that I had occupied my time, right? I was doing things.
Mm-hmm.
I think they then realized that it meant that I had to store all of my findings.
Mm.
And so I would come back from trips with rocks, with leaves, with live animals, sometimes insects. And I think that created quite the liveliness, I guess, around the house. For my parents, they were always having to think about, okay, well, he can't keep bringing acorns into the house. This is like the eighth acorn he's found. Like, please, he's got to find a different thing to bring in.
So,
and I think, yeah.
What live animal did you bring that caused the most consternation?
I had a small a group of grasshoppers, actually.
Oh,
that I found that were. But, you know, it's hard to find one grasshopper, let alone, I think I had about 9 or so grasshoppers
uh-huh.
in this, like, Tupperware that I had wrangled as a kid.
Uh-huh.
And I brought them into my house, and I was going to, the goal was to see what they would eat. And so I had grabbed a bunch of different leaves and sticks, and I said, they're called grasshoppers, but I've never seen them eat any grass. So I was testing this idea, will they eat the grass that I leave for them?
Uh-huh.
Only I had just, you know, 10 grasshoppers in my house. And so that was yeah, that went over about as well as you'd expect.
Yeah. Did you open it and did they get out?
They didn't get out.
Okay.
But I did. I was prepared to open them in the kitchen and was promptly
shut down. I love that. So as a kid, you were observing the world, but you didn't consider it science. But then when did you realize that what you were doing could be considered science?
I think that moment really goes back to my first sort of academic association with science. Mm-hmm. It was a marine ecology course in undergraduate, actually. But the professor of that course really valued observation, and he made a point throughout the course that, especially for natural scientists, a lot of our hypotheses and the ways that we think about the world are formed through observation. And he grounded the course in this simple idea that you should first observe things and spend time observing, right? So take a little bit of time to look at something that seems maybe mundane, mm-hmm. and see what changes, mm-hmm. and then take those observations and then make that into maybe a heuristic about how the world or pattern might work. And it was in this course where I realized, I've made these observations before, and I feel like I didn't recognize it as such. But now looking back, I see that as the core of at least my scientific inquiry.
Now, I think you said the word heuristic, and I've seen it before, but I've forgotten what it means.
Yeah. So when I say heuristic there, I just mean the ways that we refer to sort of abstract concepts. So the idea of an ecosystem is a really useful, like, heuristic, mm-hmm. to think about the ways that life is organized on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a bunch of different types of those heuristics that we use in natural science to make sense of the world around us.
Okay. So it sounds like there was a gap from when you were a kid to when you went to college where you realized that you actually were a scientist. So how did you feel about the sciences in general before that course?
No, this is a great question, because I think I had a tangible interest in what I had called natural science and science courses and books,
mm-hmm.
but I hadn't thought really about taking that into either a career direction, mm-hmm. or work.
Mm-hmm.
And even as recent as maybe last year or a few years ago, before starting in my graduate research program, I still had a fairly underdeveloped idea of what it meant to work in a career as a scientist.
Mm.
I think a lot of that has changed as I've navigated the field. I'm in graduate school. I think a lot about next steps after I leave the program.
Mm-hmm.
But for science, it feels fairly abstract, sort of how to become a scientist. And I think as a kid, that idea was especially vague and abstract. Mm. And so one of the things that's been really helpful has been one of my mentors,
mm-hmm.
having people that I can see in my proximity who are doing science work in their careers,
mm-hmm.
But then also engaging with curiosity at outreach and museums,
mm-hmm.
so going to different events where those occur in the community, reaching out to prospective employers or groups to sort of see what their day-to-day looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think having a nice network of peers in the field really supported my understanding around what it means to sort of have a career in science.
That's really interesting, because I think that as a kid, when you think of scientists, you think of a guy in a white lab coat holding test tubes, pouring things in with like a little smoke, maybe some glasses and a white lab. That's kind of the traditional thing that you see on TV or in cartoons. So it makes sense that you wouldn't make that leap until you actually have someone say, hey, this is also science.
Exactly. And I think that it's one of the greater, I guess, disservices that maybe we do to the young scientists, because I think a lot of us recognize observation and curiosity as things that are a part of our childhood.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think a lot of us realize that those are the same skills that a lot of practicing and professional scientists use every day. And I think that, yeah, if more people knew, I think that there would be more eagerness around science careers in particular.
Okay. So when you were taking that class, the pivotal class, what sorts of things would your instructor have you guys do?
An exercise that I love that I actually do when I take interns out is I challenge students, and people can do this too out on the beach or just publicly or in nature on a trail at the park.
Mm-hmm.
Find something, a subject of focus for you, and focus on it for 5 minutes. Like, set a timer, and you're just going to stare at this thing for 5 minutes straight, and you're going to observe it.
Mm-hmm.
And this process of staying still and taking note for 5 minutes really grounded you, the observer, in place, which is really important as a scientist. But then also, you notice so much, because I think we live a very fast life as people going, you know, through the world. And so taking that moment to pause can really draw attention to the subtlest of changes that might be visible right, you know, outside your backyard. So in the course, we focus on not only observation as like a sort of like way to pass the time, but also as a way to generate questions and or ideas about the world. So if we were observing, let's say that there was one species of crab consistently located in the rocks everywhere, then that might lead us to develop a hypothesis about where those crabs are and what might be driving that distribution.
So is that something you also do with young children? Because it seems like they're able to focus for 5 minutes at least on a starfish or an anemone or, you know, those little eddies that occur at the beach.
Definitely, definitely. It's a great activity for younger minds in particular, I think, just because it's a really simple premise, but I think you'll find that it's really accessible.
Understood. So let me ask you this. So you graduate from this course, and now what was the next step in your science journey?
Yeah, so the course really propelled me to think about science as the way to conduct research, so academic research, so thinking about questions of the natural world and designing ways to answer those questions, whether they be through methods or experiments like the one that I have currently running. And then I took the interest that I had in the course and I applied it to a local ecosystem in North Carolina, oyster reef. And so oysters, if you guys aren't necessarily familiar, are these small, like bivalves mollusks. They have two shells. But they're really important filter feeders. And so they eat plankton in the water and filter it out. And they keep the water clean as a byproduct, so just in the process of eating. And they're really important to keep waters healthy, especially near shore waters that get a lot of terrestrial or land-based input. And so I was really interested in how we might use natural predators to regulate these disease-causing snails that live on oysters by basically scaring the snails with the smell of a predator to see if we could scare the snails such that oysters had a better time overall. And that work culminated in what we would call like an honors thesis in undergrad. So I was able to write that up as a part of my program, and that really propelled me into this position as a research technician, where I continued sort of developing this idea, and then led me to consider applying to PhD programs for advanced research.
Excellent. Now, I have a bunch of stupid questions for you, but I'm sincere about this, which is, how do you know you've frightened a snail? Because like with fish, if you frighten them, they dart away. But a snail barely moves. So how can you tell that you're frightening a snail? And what do you frighten a snail with so that they stay away from the oysters?
Great questions. Great questions. And so one of the the first one, how do we tell the snails are afraid?
Mm-hmm.
Well, like you're saying, if we scared a fish, we would know because the fish would be very agitated. It would be moving a lot. It would probably have its eyes visibly darting around. It would be breathing really hard. We could see all of these things in the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And we can record similar responses in snails, even though, like you said, they are a lot slower on the time scale.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was using to record my snail's fear response was measuring how far they moved over the set unit of time. So let's say we had two snails in my experiment,
mm-hmm.
one of them that I wanted to scare, one of them that I didn't want to scare.
Okay.
But because snails are able to sense chemicals from their environment with their antennae, and these sensory organs on their face, we can actually use water that has sort of held a crab. We don't have to actually keep a crab alive to scare the snails. So I call this process making like a crab tea of sorts, like a tea made from a crab.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
If you imagine, but the tea bag is a crab.
Okay.
And so you steep the crab for a set number of times. And as long as you record how much that crab weighs and how long it sat in the water,
mm-hmm.
when you scare the snail, you can standardize how scared the snails get by how big of a crab and how long you soaked that crab in the tea.
Wow.
So what I measure to scare the snails is I measure how far they move across the bottom of the dish when exposed to pure seawater that's been filtered. And then when they are exposed to this crafty concoction that we make.
And then go on again about, so you measure their distance. What was the distance?
Oh, it's, they're fairly, so like you said, they're snails. They don't move a ton. So it's a few millimeters per hour.
Okay.
Per minute.
Okay.
Usually, we get a standardized metric per minute, so
uh-huh.
we record them for an hour. So if you imagine watching a snail for an hour, they don't move very far.
Right.
But one of the things that we found really useful for this is that you can use sand, and if you place sand on the bottom of whatever this arena is that you want to scare the snails in,
uh-huh.
when they run and move, they'll actually leave a visible trail in the sand.
Oh.
And so one thing we were able to do is take a picture of that trail, and then we can use an image software to determine how long of a distance they moved over the time that we observed them moving.
Okay, well, that brings me, since snails move so slowly, it doesn't seem like if there were a real crab in the vicinity, their goose is cooked because crabs can move fairly quickly, correct?
Exactly, yes.
So how far away can they sense a crab to be able to move so that they can save themselves? Is it like how, what concentration do they start noticing it?
I think there are probably a few different cues that come into play in the snail's processing center to determine the risk level.
Okay.
And so we find that even, let's say there were 50 snails. I measured a lot more than 50 snails.
Okay.
For this experiment, but let's say there were 50 or so snails. We might expect that there's an average concentration of crab that all of those snails would respond to and show a fear response for.
Okay.
But within that, we would still expect there to be individual variation where maybe some individuals are, we don't like to humanize them too much, but quote unquote bolder individuals mm-hmm. might be less scared at higher concentrations. You might have scaredy cat snails that are more likely to leave an area at lower concentrations.
Mm-hmm.
And this might all be, acceptable natural variation in the population. One thing that's really interesting is that we found through this experiment, actually, that maybe running isn't actually the response that they show to to crab cues. So we showed that the distance that they move is not that significant across crab smell versus non-crab smell, but that the length of time that they moved it was significant, so that they moved faster over a similar length of time. And what this suggests is that there might be more of a benefit to staying still and hiding if you're a snail and you see a potential crab than actively moving to make yourself visible. And so we sort of saw some evidence that suggests that maybe the first response these snails experience is actually to hunker down and to stop moving before they try to get away from what's trying to eat them.
Is it so that they can blend in with the environment?
Exactly.
Okay.
So these are really small snails, and they live in really close association with the oysters that they like to eat. And so they can actually hide themselves pretty conspicuously on the edges of oyster shells. And crabs really aren't the best at finding things. I mean, they can find things that are big enough passively, but they're not search and rescue by any means.
Okay.
So I think for them, it decreases the odds that any given one of them is found by a crab if they stop moving.
Got it. Now, how big are these snails that are eating these oysters? Because you said that they're very small, and I think of an oyster as being bigger than a snail.
Exactly. So we call these snails in particular oyster mosquitoes, and if that gives you a sort of a reference point for the scale between the oyster and the snail. And basically, an adult oyster can host anywhere from 30 to 40 of these individual snails. And so when I did my experiment, I was scaring oysters. I was scaring snails at different densities off of oysters. And I used 5 snails, I used 10 snails, and then my high density treatment was 25 individual snails per oyster. And so you can really get, quite a high density of individuals on an oyster. And this has significant effects on the oyster's health. Mm-hmm. So the big thing is that the oyster will filter less because these particular snails like to eat the oyster tissue at the margins of the two shells. So every time the oyster opens its shell to filter, it exposes a lot of its body to consumption by these snails. So as a direct result of these snails consuming the oyster, sort of being like a mosquito and sort of sucking on the hemolymph or the tissue of the oyster, they filter a lot less and end up subsequently at risk to higher mortality as a result.
Okay. You've painted quite a picture. I imagine, I just feel like it's being swarmed by snails, but, at the snail's timeline.
Yeah, exactly. On a snail timeline. And so one of the cool things that also came out of this specific project is this idea that maybe snails, in addition to getting information about their environment from the environment, they might also be getting information about their relative risk from one another. And so we found that in larger groups of snails, the response by each individual snail was greater than if that same group of snails was in a lesser dense group of snails.
Understood. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's touching your mind right now? We've got science envoy Ryan Rogers, and you are currently in the midst of an experiment. Are you free to talk about what that experiment is?
I am. I would happily talk about my current experiment.
Please.
Studying seagrass ecosystems.
Now, what are seagrass ecosystems for those of us who, you know, like aquariums, but we just think they're pretty?
Yeah, no. So seagrass is a land plant that over millions of years has sort of evolved to live back in marine environments. And so it creates these dense sort of underwater meadows, beds of this plant mm-hmm. that are host to all sorts of marine organisms like fish, crabs, invertebrates, and algae.
Okay.
And much like how a tree is the foundation of a forest on land, each individual seagrass plant forms the foundation of this bed, this ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And my experiment specifically looked at how the different individual sites or where we find a seagrass plant affects the way it looks and its capacity to provide habitat for other organisms. And so what I'm specifically interested in with this experiment is how might we people modify natural environments in ways that either support seagrasses mm-hmm. and or degrade seagrass habitat and their capacity to provide habitat for other organisms.
Okay, so you have, say, an organ, a seagrass bed over here and a seagrass bed over there. What are the differences between them that affect whether one's going to thrive and another one's going to degrade?
Exactly.
Okay, so how do you measure that?
Some of those factors?
Yeah, how do you measure that? I mean, like what are you looking for?
The first step usually is what we call the site characterization or site selection.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would go to a place where we've seen seagrass,
okay.
and we might start just measuring environmental variables. So these are things like water temperature, water salinity, nutrient concentrations. Mm-hmm. So we measure the in-water nitrate concentrations, which tells us how much extra nitrogen is in the water. We measure dissolved oxygen, which tells us how much oxygen is in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Sediment grain size, so really fine sediment or closer to mud, whereas mm-hmm. Coarser sediment might be closer to sand.
Okay.
And all these factors might shape how healthy a given seagrass bed is. And so when I go out to two seagrass beds and I want to compare them, I might say, okay, what is the sediment type here?
Mm-hmm.
What is the flow? What direction is the current moving? How much seagrass is here? Is this an area that should support more seagrass than it does?
Mm-hmm.
Or is the seagrass really healthy given that it's right next to a water treatment facility
mm.
or that it's right next to a power plant? And what might be some of those differences that we would expect?
It feels like there's so much variation in the environment that you wouldn't be able to get a stable set of data that could be extrapolated for all. Am I reading that properly?
I think there is naturally a lot of variation,
mm-hmm.
But seagrass ecosystems are fairly consistent temporally. And so because the grass likes to modify conditions to support itself,
mm-hmm.
it actually changes conditions in the environment and makes them more similar across seagrass beds across sites than you might expect. And so while there are, like, for example, seagrass beds in San Diego that are obviously going to be in warmer temperatures or maybe with less tidal flow, compared to a seagrass bed in Northern California, maybe up in Humboldt Bay,
mm-hmm.
you might expect the seagrass to be in colder water with maybe more influence flow. But you would still expect there to be some fundamental things about those two seagrass beds that allow you to make that comparison.
And what are those fundamental things that that allow you to make that comparison?
Yeah, one is the presence of the plants themselves. So each site will have a different density of the seagrass plant,
mm-hmm.
and the density of the seagrass plant modifies how the water moves across the seagrass bed, which affects things like the flow rate and the sediment quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things we measure across wide geographic scale, sort of like you're suggesting, is the condition of the plants themselves. So that is how closely together are the plants relative to one another, how many blades does each individual shoot have,
mm-hmm.
how many species are there. Okay. Here in California, it's pretty simple because there's only ever one species that's really forming the beds that I study. But in the tropical ecosystems where I do some of my work, there's multiple species. And so one of the other ways we categorize a site is we go and we look at what species of seagrass are there,
okay.
and what species are not. And that lets us also speak a little bit to bed quality and habitat conditions.
Okay. So when you say that the seagrasses will change their environment to what they want it to be, how does that happen?
Yeah. So one of the first things that happens is seagrasses have a root system.
Okay.
And so they're very different from algae. So if you think of kelp, like giant kelp, it makes these big forests mm-hmm. like underwater.
Mm-hmm.
But kelp aren't plants. And so they don't have a root system that's attaching them to the sand or the ground. And they actually grow directly on rocks and are holding onto those rocks with specialized structures.
What is kelp if it's not a plant? Is it a lot? I mean, what is it?
Kelp is a type of algae.
Oh, okay.
And so algae are these really weird life forms that are mostly photosynthetic and mostly marine, but there mm-hmm. are freshwater algae, there are terrestrial algae, and they're mainly different from plants in that they lack specialized structures like roots and leaves and flowers.
Okay.
Whereas a lot of the land plants have these really special structures that are a direct result of living on land.
Mm-hmm.
The algae don't have those structures just because they're older life forms.
Okay. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to derail you. So going back to how they convert their environment, so they have these root systems.
Yeah. And what the roots do is that they go down to extract minerals out the sand.
Mm-hmm.
As a direct product of that, like as a byproduct of that, they also compact the sand. And so the sand is less loose
mm-hmm.
and is more stable over time where there are seagrasses. And what this means is that over time, once seagrass is established, if more of it continues to grow there, the water and the conditions facilitate seagrass in the future.
Mm.
So seagrass doesn't like turbid water, and it needs the water to be very clear to mm-hmm. be able to photosynthesize.
Mm-hmm.
And when that sediment is all loose and stirred up, it ends up getting resuspended really easily. And so what a nice root network of seagrasses is doing, in addition to supporting the plant itself and giving it the stuff it needs,
mm-hmm.
is also stabilizing the sediment, which mm-hmm. makes the water overall clearer in a seagrass bed compared to in a not seagrass bed. And so that's just one example of how the physical structure of the plant, in addition to, you know, doing things for the organism, also modify the environment in a way that indirectly resupport the organism.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you can find these seagrass beds near treatment facilities. Is that something, is having a seabed there a way of helping to clean up the waters near treatment facilities, or do the treatment facilities somewhat poison the seabeds?
It's exactly the former.
Oh, yeah.
There's a strong interest in these habitats because of their value to store and trap inorganic components out of the water,
mm-hmm.
Just because they drift and settle on the plants, and then they get covered by depositing material. A lot of what people are wondering is, if these ecosystems are so good at filtering out excess nutrients
mm-hmm.
or storing heavy metals in the sediment, maybe we should place them strategically at outflows or contaminated and or cleaned water. And so one of the things you'll see a lot is exactly this interest in co-locating these green sort of ocean habitats mm-hmm. next to human uses for wastewater and not just wastewater. So, like, one of the sites that I collect from for this experiment is a big agricultural valley, and it experiences a lot of nutrient runoff. And so mm-hmm. we think a lot about the value of seagrass habitat being able to buffer some of that nutrient addition and prevent some of that runoff.
Interesting. And what kinds of sea life do these grasses support?
About 75% or about 75% of all commercially relevant fish species in California mm-hmm. Actually rely on a seagrass bed at some point in their life.
Really?
And so they're massively important habitats at the scale of like coral reefs. For a lot of the species that we like to think of as sort of emblematic of the state. So halibut, Dungeness crab, clam, rockfish, all these species rely on seagrass beds both as foraging ground, as refuge, so a safety habitat from predators, mm-hmm. as nursery ground, the places to rear young and to have young grow. And yeah, the valuation of that is some odd, you know, $3 billion or so, I would say, is the economic valuation of seagrass habitats in the state to fisheries. And so there are a ton of species that rely on seagrasses at some point. But the vast majority of species that do rely on seagrasses rely on them as nursery habitat.
So raising their kids.
Yes.
And hiding their children.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Keeping them safe from other big things that want to eat them. And a seagrass bed, if you think about it, they're often dense with a lot of other leaves and plants, provide a lot of cover and places to hide for juvenile fish and crabs.
Okay, okay. Is there any danger of seagrasses being invasive or choking the natural environment?
We don't really see too much on specific species being invasive, only because they're fairly widely distributed, all of the seagrass species.
Mm-hmm.
There are... I'm blanking off the top of my head for how many total there are in the world, mm-hmm. but in California, there are 4 seagrass species,
mm-hmm.
And one of them is ubiquitous across the whole state. And so we don't really think about it as being an invasive because it's just so widely distributed.
Mm-hmm.
But there is concern that, especially as water temperatures are increasing, will seagrasses shift their current distributions such that, you know, seagrasses that live in one part of the state now might be found in a different part of the state in the future.
Okay, okay. So what is something that you learned about seagrasses that just blew your mind?
That the amount of space, so seagrasses cover, I would say, it's about 2% or so mm-hmm. of the surface area, like globally.
Mm-hmm.
Just like if you were to take a map of the, like a globe, mm-hmm. and you were to color in a part of the globe that had all of the seagrass,
mm-hmm.
it would be about 2% or so of the area of the globe you would cover. But in that 2%, half or 50% of the ocean's carbon dioxide stores or inert carbon dioxide stores
mm-hmm.
are stored within seagrass habitat. So specifically marine underwater vegetation, so seagrasses. And this just emphasizes the outsized role that these habitats play mm-hmm. in the ocean's carbon cycling.
Okay.
Because they're plants, they actually, you know, photosynthesize.
Mm-hmm.
They consume CO2 in the water column, and then they produce oxygen. And this consumption of CO2 means that the oceanic CO2 goes down and is actually lower in seagrass beds relative to, you know, ambient conditions.
Okay.
And so when we think of like the superpowers of seagrasses, One of them is that despite only covering a fraction of a percent of land area, they're responsible for a whopping half of all of the stored carbon in the ocean.
Wow. Wow. And how deep can you find seagrasses?
Most seagrasses, because, again, they are plants. They need to be able to have sunlight to make their energy. And so a lot of them are limited to the upper few meters. So I would say 10 to 8 meters or so. Mm-hmm. Although the deepest seagrass beds, some of the Mediterranean beds, and some beds in the Pacific can be anywhere from 30 meters deep to 33 meters deep.
So oh, wow.
You can get down there. Yeah.
Okay.
If the water's clear enough for them.
Oh, okay. So the clarity of the water is a big determinant on how deep they can be.
Exactly. It's the amount of unobstructed or available light that they have at that level of depth to support their growth.
And are there any specific species that really, really that couldn't survive if there were no seagrasses?
One of them is actually a species that I have in my tank for the experiment. Is the Taylor's sea hare. It's a small green sea slug. They're soft-bodied, really, really cute animals. But they live and look like seagrass blades. So they're really bright green. They have stripes. And they spend their lives living on an individual seagrass plant or eating any of the algae or other invertebrates that try to grow and foul and cover up the seagrass blade.
Wow.
And so they sort of work together with the plant to keep it clean, and then the plant is able to grow more to provide a richer habitat for the invertebrates.
Got it. Now, when you talk to children, how do you describe what it is you do?
When one of the things I start with is, again, this question about observation. So often I'll say my work as a marine ecologist or scientist is making observations in the natural world about the functioning of ecosystems, about the movement and position of animals, the distributions of organisms, and the ways that people interact with these things, environments and organisms, to shape the interactions that we observe.
Okay. And now, to go full circle, have you run across in your adult life a child who is like you, who likes to walk around in the garden or in nature and figure out stuff?
I have. I've had, so I grew up in Durham, North Carolina, and so I actually taught a summer education course there, and I had several participants come up to me remarking that they had either A, never heard of ecology or never done natural science or never considered being a scientist, even though they had, like you're sort of saying, this really strong curiosity in the bugs, in the plants, in the things around them. And I found that, you know, those children in particular really resonated with the message that, you know, what you're doing is already science.
Oh.
And so you've shown yourself already to be a capable scientist. And it really sort of serves as a model of possibility for those students to know that the behaviors and then the things that they like to do are things that lend themselves to a career in science.
That is excellent. And I know that you have to get back to your experiment, so I want to ask one more question, which is, if people want to find out more about your research, how do they go about doing it? And this is a two-parter, which is for people who want to know more but aren't necessarily scientifically trained, is there a resource that you would recommend for them?
About my research in particular?
About your research, or if people want to find out about your research, or if people are interested in finding out more about seabeds.
Yeah, no, perfect. So one of the resources I would say, I'll shameless plug, is the Hopkins Marine Station. That's Stanford University's Marine Lab. I have a biography on the website there as one of the graduate students, and so there's a more technical blurb there about the specific research questions and some of the implications of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And then my contact information is also on the website. And so if anything that we talked about today is really resonant, or if there's just, you know, more interest in this idea of how to engage curiosity
mm-hmm.
to show, you know, science as a pathway, I have my contact there for outreach and connections. I would say for more interest in seagrasses generally,
mm-hmm.
there's the Seagrass Genome Project, and they publish a lot of, I would say, public-facing materials about what are seagrass habitats, what's the value of seagrasses, where are they found, what are some of the benefits. I've found that especially here in California,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of public awareness of kelp forests and the value that they provide. But we also have a ton of seagrass habitats here in California, and I don't think that they get enough of the spotlight. And so I would highly recommend that resource, as well as the Elkhorn Slough Estuary Reserve, which is one of the last largest extents of seagrasses in California.
Excellent. Well, Ryan Rogers, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today and for taking time out of your experiment to talk with us about this subject.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, and I really enjoyed it. I hope it went really well.
I think it did. People of Earth, science, it's not just for breakfast anymore. There are things that you're probably doing that you don't even know you're using the scientific method for, but you find out, and there are things that your children are doing, and you can point out what you're doing, this observation, it's scientific. So I'm so happy that scientists are willing to talk to me and endure my questions. I hope you all are enjoying your lives. It's time for me to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. It'll be pleasuring your ear hole. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
Thank you.